It's 8 o'clock in South Central Wisconsin, and you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. We're also streaming on the web, or at least we should be. The last time I looked, the website was down, and our tech wizards have been notified about that, and they're working on it. And of course, you can access this program and all WORT shows through the WORT mobile app. We've got the 8 o'clock buzz coming up soon after BBC World News headlines. This is Peter Haney saying we'll see you at the usual time on Tuesday morning next week.
I'm Debbie Russ with the BBC News. Hello. Marine Le Pen has been barred from running in the French presidential election 2 years from now. Judges found the far-right leader guilty of embezzling EU funds and banned her from running for public office for 5 years. The court handed down, a four-year prison sentence, half of it suspended, after finding her guilty of using European parliamentary allowances to fund her party's activities. Hugh Schofield is in Paris.
The implications are very clear. Unless there's some twist which I can't foresee, she's not going to be able to run in 2027, which is a major change, a major blow to her hopes, a major shake-up of the political situation here. It had always been presumed that Marine Le Pen was on course for her fourth and most likely successful attempt at the presidency in 2027. Things are looking her way. Her party is doing very well. It's consistently shown in elections to be the biggest in the country. She had 13 million votes behind it last year, and now she cannot run.
Relief teams are grappling with a growing humanitarian crisis in Myanmar following Friday's massive earthquake. The country's military rulers say more than 2,000 people are now known to have died, but the final figure is expected to be much higher. Shaima Khalil reports.
A pastor in Mandalay, the closest city to the earthquake's epicenter, has told the BBC that fear and helplessness have taken over his community. Roate said that residents haven't been able to sleep in their homes since the 7.7 earthquake struck on Friday, adding that power and supplies are running out. Hospitals in Myanmar are overwhelmed. An official from the World Health Organization has told the BBC that at least three hospitals were completely out of service, while another 22 are partially damaged and not able to function. The International Rescue Committee said that the rescue teams on the ground in Myanmar are having to navigate damaged roads, landslides and debris to reach affected communities.
Russia's sought down to play down President Trump's remarks over the weekend that he's angry with Vladimir Putin over his delaying tactics regarding a ceasefire in Ukraine and the credibility of President Zelensky. The Kremlin spokesman said some of Mr. Trump's reported statements were not direct quotations, adding that President Putin remained open to contact with Donald Trump. From Moscow, here's Steve Rosenberg.
At the weekend, Donald Trump had said he was very angry and disappointed with Russia. The Kremlin tried to play down the criticism. Vladimir Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters that some of what Donald Trump had said on the subject of Russia, President Putin and Ukraine had been paraphrased. It was not direct quotations. He said the Kremlin continued to work with America, first and foremost on improving bilateral relations and on several areas related to the Ukraine peace process. That, he added, was drawn out due to its complicated nature.
This is the latest world news from the BBC.
Election Day is around the corner next Tuesday. WORT has interviewed candidates for City Council, and we've put together a candidate guide with those interviews and more. Find it online at wortfm.org/candidates and find what you need to be ready to vote. That's at myvote.wi.gov. Say it's my country.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Budget Bicycle Center's used bicycle showroom located at 930 Regent Street. Open for curbside service estimates and sales, 251-1663. More information on Budget Bicycles services for new and used bicycles is available on the web at budgetbicyclectr.com.
Good morning, it's 8:05. You're tuned to the Monday 8 o'clock buzz on WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org. This is Brian Standing. The most expensive Wisconsin Supreme Court election in state history takes place tomorrow, as do elections for state superintendent of public instruction and a host of school board and city council seats. Vote Beat Wisconsin's Alexander Schur brings us up to date on election eve. And we continue our look at the impact of Trumponomics on Wisconsin's agricultural economy. We'll talk with Wisconsin Secretary of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, Randy Romanski. And finally, Laotian American filmmaker Nkauzwa Zhang, also known as NK, brings her intimate documentary portrait of her father to the Wisconsin Film Festival. NK joins us with a preview. We'll have all that, plus some announcements, the Outdoor Adventure Report, and some tasty tunes served up by your engineer, John Wilson. All that's coming up right after this. It's 8:08. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. Tomorrow, April 1st, Wisconsin holds its spring elections for state Supreme Court, superintendent of public instruction, and a variety of local government and school board races. Ostensibly nonpartisan, the 2025 campaign for the Wisconsin Supreme Court has been anything but. Centibillionaire Elon Musk has described the Wisconsin race in apocalyptic terms, saying the results could determine the fate of Western civilization. Along with fellow billionaires Diane Hendricks, Elizabeth Uline, and Joe Ricketts, Musk has poured tens of millions of dollars into the race to support conservative Waukesha Judge Brad Schimmel. On the other side, George Soros, J.B. Pritzker, and Gloria Page have spent similar sums to support liberal Dane County Judge Susan Crawford. Total spending in the race could top $100 million, doubling the amount spent on the 2023 Supreme Court race. Here joining us with the latest on tomorrow's election is Vote Beat Wisconsin reporter Alex Schur. Welcome back to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Glad to be here.
So we've never seen anything like this with the state Supreme Court race. I mean, the amount of outside money that has been spent in this is just astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, so for context, the Supreme Court election 2 years ago, which was about $50 million total spending, was a record-breaking, naturally a record-breaking judicial race, and this is doubling that. So, I mean, no, it's wild. This is brand new for, I mean, state races, Supreme Court races, nonpartisan, in quotes, judicial races. This is pretty brand new.
Is this the new normal? Is this what we're going to be seeing? Are we going to be seeing $200 million the next time we do this?
You know, as long as there is gridlock between the legislature and governor, you know, if each is controlled by different parties, I think so. I mean, like, the court could be de-emphasized if one party takes both of those branches, but I mean, it's always going to matter. It could always matter this much.
Now, we mentioned Elon Musk in the introduction, and the richest man in the world has offered to pay people $1 million if they vote for Brad Schimmel. How is this legal?
Well, it's a pretty good deal. Yeah, and it might not be legal. So allegedly, it's not legal. So Attorney General Josh Call, a Democrat, he did file a lawsuit on Friday because Elon Musk announced a few days ago that yesterday he'd be giving out $1 million to two people who signed a petition that said they were against activist judges. So this petition did not mention the Wisconsin Supreme Court, didn't mention the date of the election, but it was kind of using language that Brad Schimmel, the conservative court candidate, uses to describe liberal justice. But then to sign up for the event where he was giving out $1 million, they had to say, people trying to go had to say how they were going to vote. So it was like getting closer and closer and closer to being about the election. But you can't pay someone to vote. And actually, you can't receive money to vote. Both are felonies. Josh Call is he just filed a civil lawsuit. A legal expert told me after the fact there could be a criminal prosecution. I don't know if anyone's going to prosecute, you know, a voter for receiving money or Musk, as to be determined. But, you know, it gets close to Wisconsin's election bribery statute, which prohibits payments for in exchange for voting. I mean, I should add, I was in Green Bay yesterday, and Musk at this event is speaking between two televisions that are saying, vote for Brad Schimmel on April 1st. So these people, all of them received money because for signing this initial petition, you received $100. So all these people received money. Two of these people received $1 million, and there's a pretty clear message when you go to this place that, in a way, you were paid to go to.
So why did Attorney General Call choose to file this in civil court instead of criminal court?
I don't exactly know. It could be that, you know, if the payments hadn't paid out, maybe there wasn't a felony yet, but there's also like intent. So I'm not entirely sure. I think perhaps it moves quicker as a civil case. He was just looking for an injunction. He just wanted a court order to stop these payments. He didn't even really say stop the event because, you know, First Amendment, you're entitled to a rally. But he was saying he cannot give $1 million out in exchange for voting.
So tell us about the crowd at Green Bay. What did you observe about the people there?
It was a big mix of people. I mean, there were people excited at the chance to win $1 million. There are other people who are just fascinated and really interested in Elon Musk and his federal government. You know, DOGE, government efficiency initiatives. It was a whole mix, but I mean, like, staunchly Republican. There was no mix of, you know, political belief in there, as far as I could tell. Couple thousand people. There was a protest outside, you know, people saying you cannot buy your votes. But no, it was a staunchly conservative crowd. Senator Ron Johnson spoke. It was a rally for Schimmel, and then Musk kind of did a Q&A about all things government, whatever the crowd wanted to know.
And you know, we've talked a lot about the sort of Elon Musk and the funding that goes into that, but Susan Crawford's been getting a lot of outside money as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no shortage of money on either side. There's no shortage of outstate spending. I think what sets Elon Musk apart is how he's spending the money. The fact that he's basically just stopping short of paying a voter to vote. And I mean, I should add, this Green Bay event that Josh Call filed a lawsuit over, initially Call only was inviting people who'd already voted in the court election. And once he posted that, everyone was like, no, you can't do that. And then Musk deleted that tweet and kind of walked it back a little bit. But, you know, no, I mean, I think what I read was Crawford's campaign is leading Schimmel's campaign and spending and fundraising, but in dark money groups, Schimmel's kind of leading. But no, I mean, both of them are making tens of millions of dollars, a lot of outstate funders, a lot of billionaires. If you look at it that way, it's similar. It's really just this, like, how close are we getting to the election bribery statute that you're seeing on, I mean, Elon Musk is the sole example. You can't even say the right. It's just Musk.
So in other election news, we got yet another executive order from President Trump dealing with elections, and one we're talking about ballot barcodes. What's going on here?
Yeah, so this is a sweeping executive order kind of designed to address a lot of Trump's policy goals for elections, some of which he's, you know, trying to get through Congress and they're not quite passing. So there's a few things here, and I'm going to kind of list them and say what applies to Wisconsin. So one example, there's a federal registration form to register for elections. And this executive order said from now on, this form is going to require proof of citizenship, which is a really controversial measure. But in Wisconsin, a couple years ago, a judge banned the state from using that form. So that doesn't apply here. Trump also in his executive order said all ballots received after Election Day cannot be counted. That doesn't apply to Wisconsin. Every ballot must be received by 8 p.m. And I should add, all of this is for federal races, not state races. One thing that does apply here, as you pointed out, is Trump said in the order that if a ballot is printed on a barcode, say, you know, I'll give one example. There's ES&S Express Vote is a type of voting machine, and it prints the results on paper, written out on a paper ballot, but there's also a barcode there. There's kind of this idea that, or pretty much a conspiracy theory that could get hacked, those results could get hacked. So Trump said no barcodes on ballots. That would affect all of those machines. Each result has a barcode. So Portage County, for example, all of their machines are express votes. If they had to replace all of them, it would be something like $1 million. So we'll see if that happens. I should add there are expected to be legal challenges against its executive order.
So talking about the sort of federal form, is that a form that applies in some states but not in other states? It's the first time I've heard of a federal registration form.
Yeah, I think it's called the National Mail Registration Form. It was passed under a federal law, required under this law, but Wisconsin, for a couple reasons, Wisconsin's exempted from the National Voter Registration Act because they have same-day registration voting. One of the maybe six states that do that. So I think that sort of exempts the state from the form, but more so a conservative group actually will, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, sued over this form, saying this form does not ask for things that are required under state law. So a judge stopped it from being used, but no, around the country it is used. I don't know how often it's used. I know in Wisconsin, for example, before it was banned, it was hardly used. I don't know if that's the case in other states, but, you know, from now on, under this executive order, again, we'll see if this is challenged, there's going to be a slot for citizenship proof.
And what would that proof entail? How would you prove you're a citizen?
I mean, birth certificate, maybe passport. And this is, you know, there's been a long debate over voter ID. You know, do people have an ID or a military ID or a student ID that's valid for voting, all these things? There's studies that show that citizenship proof is a lot harder to, you know, find than your voter ID. I mean, like, imagine a kid in college, they probably don't have their birth certificate. I mean, maybe some do, but
they're not easy to carry around with you on a regular basis, like a driver's license is.
It's not second nature to us,
right.
I guess.
Right. We had a good question actually called in from a listener. So all this money that we're talking about in the state Supreme Court race, you know, this $100 million or so, where does most of that go? What is that spent on? Is that all television advertising or social media? Do we have any breakdown of how that money is spent?
All of the things. There is a breakdown. I don't have it in front of me, but I mean, they're paying canvassers to knock on people's doors. They're, you know, as everybody is saying, they're paying for television ads. And this isn't just the campaigns. These are outside groups who are advertising either for one candidate or against one candidate. Mailers, stump speeches, travel expenses. It's, I mean, I think, like, especially in Madison, but probably across the state, we're surrounded by messaging about it. Each of those words costs money. Every mailer you're seeing, television ad you're seeing, all that costs a lot of money. And I mean, the fascinating part of this is this will be a $100 million race. There are, what, 4 million voters in Wisconsin? And usually the difference in these races is pretty low. I mean, I don't know about Supreme Court races recently, but like presidential races, usually 1%. So if you think of like the swing voters or the margin you need for the results to change, the cost per one of those votes is like astronomically high.
And that's not even counting $1 million for each vote.
Right, exactly, exactly.
Real quickly, I want to talk a little bit about something that's going on about how you have got an article in VoteBeat about how one Wisconsin county was helping municipalities expand the hours for early voting. We've heard a lot about this, and there's been a lot of controversy about this. Tell us more about this particular case.
Yeah, I mean, so for, I don't know, quite a long time, Democrats have been embracing absentee voting and early voting. In 2020, Trump kind of criticized all of that, and Republicans didn't do that. And Republican operatives saw that that wasn't helping them at the ballot box, that if people didn't show up on election day, say there was a storm, then they weren't voting at all. So the Republican Party kind of came around to early voting. And I mean, like, so we're talking Washington County, which is one of the most Republican counties in the state. So that's the kind of partisan logic there. There's also this logic, let's find a way for everybody to vote and give people, this is especially a talking point in Washington County, let's give people the same hours to vote as they have in Milwaukee, where they could vote on a Saturday or before work or after work. The problem was there's a bunch of tiny municipalities in this county that were open maybe 3 days a week or a few hours a day, and there wasn't even voting access across the county. Beyond that, a lot of these people in Washington County are working in Milwaukee. By the time they're back, the place is closed. So Washington County passed a measure in last year and then renewed it this year, compensating 150% of the cost for clerks to extend their hours for early voting. And I mean, the results show it's the 10th biggest county by voting age population. They have the fourth most early votes in Wisconsin, fourth most in-person early votes, at least. So, I mean, it's something that the clerks love. You can look at this in a partisan way and say, hey, this is a way to get, you know, voters to vote. But I mean, generally, if at least our perspective at VoteBeat is, you know, if more people vote, that's good.
All right. We've been speaking with VoteBeat Wisconsin reporter Alexander Schuer. You can read more of Alex's coverage at votebeat.org/Wisconsin. Alex, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
We'll be back with the Outdoor Adventure Report, the song of the week, and some station announcements coming up right after this.
Sip the juice, I got enough to go around, and the thought takes place uptown. I grew up on a sidewalk while I learned street talk, and then taught the whole New York. I go to Queens for Queens to get the food from Brooklyn. Take money in Manhattan and never been took it. Go uptown to the Bronx and boogie down, go strong on the island, recoup and lay around. Time to build my juice back up, pop stack up, suckers get smacked up. Don't doubt the clout, you know what I'm about. My elbow gets off, knocking it out, shaking them up, waking them up, breaking them up, breaking them up. Standing on shaky ground, too close to the edge. Let's see if I know the ledge. Corners trifling, shorties here. I get cocked deep, living 40s to beer. Here's a sip for the crew that's deceased. If I get revenge, then they rest in peace. Somebody gotta suffer, I just might spare one and give a brother a fair one. Stay alerted on fees, and I do work with these like Hercules. Switch to southpaw, split your right jaw, cause I don't like y'all, I'm hype for nightfall. Smooth, but I move like an army. Pull a group down, face brothers try to bomb me. Putting brothers to rest like Elliot Ness.
Hey, it's 8:25. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. It's time, as we do each and every week, for the Outdoor Adventure Report with Master Naturalist Paul Nolder. Paul, what's happening in the big world out there?
Hey, Brother Brian. And thank you, WORT, for covering all things natural. I got a question for you. Why are birds great radio announcers?
Why is that, Paul?
Because they are always on air.
Ah.
If you think that's why our birds great radio listeners, because they are always calling. Your outdoor adventure report for the week of Monday, March 31 to Sunday, April 6 is brought to you by Fun Friends of Urban Nature Parks and Environmental Friends Groups, helping connect Madison and kids with nearby nature with outings every week year-round. Join the fun. This past week, nature lovers around Madison ordered native plants for spring planting, went on nature hikes, signed up kids for nature programs, registered for classes to learn about birding, and enjoyed seeing huge white pelicans pirouetting and tiny American woodcock sky dancing. More adventures are coming up with a big focus on migratory birds. You can join Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance for a free presentation about safer migration to reduce songbird collisions with windows on Monday evening, March 31, 6:30 at the Mount Horeb Public Library. Learn why birds hit windows and recommendations to make migrations and buildings safer for birds. Volunteers are needed to join the Bird Collision Corps in the Madison area. Join up at swibirds.org to help document window collisions and work with building owners on solutions. Migratory birds return in spring, and it's a great time to go birding. Birders of any skill level can join a local Great Wisconsin Birdathon team at wibirdathon.org. You will help count birds and raise money for Wisconsin Natural Resources Foundation, bird protection programs, and local nature groups. The International Crane Foundation encourages you to send crane hunt comments to state legislators and let them know you support meaningful funding for Wisconsin farmers that's not tied to a potentially harmful and divisive sandhill crane hunt. See usa.gov/elected officials for your local representatives and send an email or make a call. You can help birds by purchasing native plants through a native plant fundraiser for Friends of Wisdom Prairie, Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance, and SOS Save Our Songbirds. Order native trees, shrubs, and wildflowers at swibirds.org by May 11 for pickup May 17. Join Natural Resources Foundation for a free Zoom on Ho-Chunk history by Bill Quackenbush, the Tribal Historical Preservation Officer, on Tuesday, April 1, 12 noon via Zoom. See nrf.org to sign up and learn how they have lived through thousands of years of environmental change through the last several glacial episodes. Join the Friends of Nature Preserve for a free, fascinating presentation about invasive jumping worms by Director Brad Herrick, Wednesday evening, April 2, 6:30 at the Arboretum, with exhibits, refreshments, and great conversation. Bring friends, family, and kids to the science expeditions at UW with educational exhibits and kids' activities all over campus this coming weekend. Don't miss the Arboretum Exploration Session on Saturday and the Friends of Preserve on Sunday at Picnic Point featuring bird, geology, and trees. See science.wise.edu for details. And you can come to the Arboretum Saturday evening, April 5 at 7:30 to observe the Sky Dance of American Woodcocks. See arboretum.wise.edu to register by April 1. Sharing the beauty and excitement of the sport of birding on a magic of bird migration. Free outing on Saturday, April 5, 1:30 at Tenney Park Beach with naturalist Paul Melner. Learn about migrating spring birds and amazing long-distance travel stories. How do they find their way without a GPS? Come to the Arboretum Sunday, April 6 at 1 p.m. for a free family nature walk for families with children of elementary age and younger. Learn about being a responsible forager steward on a free bird nature adventure Sunday, April 6, 1:30 at Cherokee Marsh North with naturalist Kathleen Wolf. Learn about natural sources of food, why they're important to wildlife and to people over history, and how to do responsible foraging where permitted and ways to grow your own. No foraging is permitted in conservation parks. Sign up at cityofmadison.com parks to help out with Earth Week cleanup activities in your favorite local park and mark your calendar for the Sunday, April 27th, Madison Bird and Nature Festival at Warner Park. You can find details and more activities at cityofmadison.com/parks, tinyurl.com
/MadisonFunAdventures and on social media with your local environmental community and friends groups. Enjoy birds in springtime outdoors. It's naturally fun.
Thank you, Paul. And that brings us to the song of the week. John Wilson, what sounds good to you today?
Well, this past week I was up in Montreal for a little work conference, and I don't know if you know this, Brian, but a lot of folks up there speak French.
No.
And so I
c'est impossible.
Oui. And so I thought I'd celebrate a little bit of linguistic and cultural diversity with Diane Tell's 1977 Québécois pop hit, Je n'en peux plus. I think it roughly translates to, I can't take this anymore.
Je ne veux pas du tout respecter tes politesses, mon oui, ça fait des mois qu'on se connaît, et tu n'as pas encore compris, j'ai envie de lutter ta bouche, je ne veux plus te regarder courant, j'en ai les yeux qui bougent, je crois que je vais.
In the first couple of months of his second term, President Donald Trump has thrown the nation into chaos with unilateral and perhaps illegal cuts to funds already allocated by the U.S. Congress. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has been in Trump's crosshairs with the cancellation of $500 million in aid to food pantries, over $1 billion in food aid to local schools, and cuts to already awarded producer grants. Throw on top of that the Trump administration's on-again, off-again, on-again threats of tariffs, and you have a recipe for severe strains on farmers. Here in Wisconsin, one of the nation's leading agricultural states, farmers and policymakers fear economic disaster. Randy Romanski is the secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, and he joins us now by phone. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you very much, Brian. Appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today.
The producer grants that were previously allocated by Congress, and then the Trump administration announced that they were going to claw those back, and then there were threats of lawsuits, and then at some point, the Trump administration says, no, it's okay, we're going to put them back. But what's happened now? Are those still on the table? Are the ones that are already allocated still being paid out to producers, or are those still up in the air?
It's a mixed bag right now, Brian. There are some instances, and I'll use an example, the Dairy Business Innovation Initiatives. Wisconsin is one of the four hubs for that program, federally funded program, previously approved, got congressional stamp of approval. That was initially under review and on hold. Governor Evers, Wisconsin as a state, our other partner states that are part of this group, the industry, have all weighed in strongly saying, look, this is the great program. It's doing what was intended. Congress has authorized the program funding. Please release the funding. And the Dairy Business Innovation Initiative funding has been released. Some of the other holds or cancellation, it's unknown to have the impacts of some of those right as of yet, because they're still ongoing. It's a program called the Local Food Purchasing Agreement. That program has done a lot to connect those dots between new and beginning farmers or small farmers and a market that is meaningful. And we've been told here at the state level that the ongoing program for, you know, this year is allowed, but there was funding that was approved for fiscal year 25. We had signed contracts saying, yes, this funding will be available, and now that's been rescinded, unfortunately.
You mentioned signed contracts and the funding's already allocated. Is the state of Wisconsin prepared to sue if those funds are not restored?
I guess one of the things that we're trying to do is work through the process. So Governor Evers has urged the Trump administration to restore the funding for LFPA 2025. We continue to ask questions about that program. It is terminating that contract, that LFPA 2025 contract, is a departure of the federal administration's pledge to support farmers. So we are continuing to review what our options are.
Have you heard any response from USDA?
Well, the last response we got was a termination of the LFPA 25 program.
One of the things I know DATCAP does is they help administer millions of dollars of conservation funds that go directly to farmers to implement soil and water conservation practices. There's a lot of state and federal funding going into that. Have you heard anything about how safe that funding stream is?
The land and water conservation programs have been wildly popular in the state of Wisconsin. And I'm going to say farmers and organizations have really kind of taken a lead on being very proactive with soil and water conservation programs. A good portion of that is a direct thank you to Governor Evers and the legislature for finding bipartisan agreement on things like a program called the Nitrogen Optimization Program or the Produce-Led Watershed Grant Program that gives farmers tools to do more to help conserve their land and their water. Federal government plays a role in that too. As far as the funding goes, Brian, I keep in touch regularly with our finance team because things are fluid. At this point, I haven't seen an impact to the funding that might be available for some of those conservation programs, but we have to keep an eye on it because we find that programs come under that review period and that can happen quickly, so we need to be aware of that. I do have to express some concerns about the reductions to staff at the federal level. We need partners to work with farmers on their land and water conservation efforts. And I have to say that having NRCS engaged with our agency, with the local governments, with farmers, has been a big plus in recent years in trying to implement some of those practices that are good practices, best practices for soil and water conservation. It's concerning if some of those folks are no longer around to be that resource, to be that boots on the ground or best practices sounding board.
I want to shift gears a little bit. You talked about developing international markets, and one of the other things we've been hearing out of the Trump administration is tariffs on Canada, products from Canada, products from Mexico, possibly maybe even the EU. How important is that international market to Wisconsin agriculture, and are you worried about tariffs both from in anything that producers and the industry needs to import, you know, certain specialty crops or things like that that might be imported from other places. But perhaps more significantly, are you worried about the impacts of retaliatory tariffs on American and Wisconsin agricultural goods?
How important are international markets to Wisconsin? Very, very important. Wisconsin competes at a high level in the international marketplace because of the quality and diversity of products that we have. You know, I can go down the list, and I won't because it's a long list, but I'll mention a couple of them. We're known as America's Dairyland for a good reason. 90% of our milk goes into cheese. 90% of that cheese leaves our state. And so that's a big deal. We produce 25% of our nation's cheese, 50% of our nation's specialty cheese. And a lot of that cheese goes outside of the state of Wisconsin. So that's very important. We produce 60% of the nation's cranberries here in the state of Wisconsin. We produce about 90 to 95% of the ginseng that's grown in the United States, and much of that is exported. So that's a really diverse portfolio, and there's obviously much more, but I'm just kind of scratching the surface. And the important thing to mention is that Wisconsin farmers and processors compete on quality. So it's my belief that a fair, free, and open market is the best way that we can allow Wisconsin products to continue to compete in the marketplace. There's a lot of factors that are involved with international trade, but the last 4 years are the highest years for export of food, forestry, and agriculture products since the state's been keeping track of it. So what I would say, again, I go back to quality products, very diverse group of products, but also the state has identified international markets as very important, and the state has invested funding to help grow that export base. And so last year, 2024, we just got the numbers in the second highest level of food, forestry, and agriculture exports on record. So Wisconsin is trending in a good direction. And our state motto is forward, so I like to point that out. We can't afford to go backward because of artificial trade barriers that get put in the way of moving Wisconsin products around the world.
Do you have some idea of specific impacts or specific tariffs that you're particularly worried about and undermining that international presence of Wisconsin products?
Well, Wisconsin products are all over the world. We're fortunate, Brian. I mean, that diverse portfolio that Wisconsin farmers and processors have, I think Wisconsin products are in more than 150 different countries right now. That's a good thing. It helps make sure that we have new markets. But one thing I would point out is it's a neighborhood effect for Wisconsin historically, and right now, Canada and Mexico are two of our biggest trade partners. Typically, the third in our top three is China. Canada, Mexico, and China collectively account for about 60% of Wisconsin exports. That's a big deal. And so, obviously, this ongoing conversation about tariffs and potential retaliatory tariffs amongst our major trade partners is something to be aware of.
We've heard from places like Canada where retailers are taking American products off of the shelves. Are you concerned about whether there's tariffs or not? Are you concerned about the damage that this has done to good relations that form the basis of trade?
You make a really good point, Brian. A lot of international trade connections that are made is relationship-based. One of the ways that we have an international agribusiness center team here at DACAP that does help with connecting the dots between Wisconsin products and Wisconsin processors with markets around the world. And being present in those markets makes a big difference. Having quality products makes a big difference. And having a good relationship makes a big difference. So we do what we can here at the state level to try to continue those one-on-one relationships, business-to-business relationships. One way that I think...
Let me interrupt here. I mean, have you heard anything from your partners in other countries about their feeling about buying American products? Have you talked to people who are saying, you know, we don't want these things on our shelves anymore because, you know, in boycott or protest of what the Trump administration is doing? Have you heard any of those comments from some of the folks that you deal with overseas?
I actually just got back from a trade mission from Indonesia and Thailand, and another counterpart from our office here in the Secretary's Office at Wisconsin was in Guatemala recently. And the issue comes up, Brian, because there are people who are keeping a really close eye on conversations about trade that might happen between the U.S. and their country. But I haven't heard anybody use the term boycott. I haven't heard anybody say, don't want your products. In fact, quite the opposite. When Wisconsin is there, when we are present in other markets, and I consider our recent trade missions to be very productive discussions, we talk about what the opportunities are and what Wisconsin can provide. And I think that ability for us to have a conversation that we are America's Dairyland and we have quality cows, quality genetics, quality animal care, feed, everything, but we also have so much more to offer in the international market space that I think it opens doors because we can have those conversations.
Worst case scenario, let's imagine that some of the remaining grants get cut, USDA gets cut, NRCS gets cut, tariffs are imposed, there's retaliation, we're no longer in a fair trade environment with some of our major trading partners. What would that impact look like on Wisconsin and the agricultural industry?
That's a great question. It's difficult to say, Brian, because there are a whole lot of parameters that kind of fit into that scenario you put together. What I would say is we here at the state level need to continue to give voice to things that could impact our state. We need to make investments at our state level to fortify our industry here in the state, and then continue to ask our federal partners to be part of the equation as well.
All right. We've been speaking with Randy Romanski, Secretary for the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Thank you so much for joining us on the Ed Clock Buzz.
Thanks a lot, Brian. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Is that all you get for your money?
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to WORTFM.org/talkhost.
It's 8:47. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. Hmong Americans are the largest Asian population in Wisconsin, totaling over 70,000 residents, according to the 2023 American Community Survey. As allies of the United States during the Vietnam War, the Hmong faced persecution in Laos and Cambodia after the communist takeover, and many fled to the United States with U.S. government backing. Filmmaker Kung Swa Shung, who goes by NK, explores a very personal part of the Hmong diaspora as she tells her father's story in her new film, Why My Dad Loves. The film has won a Golden Badger Award in the 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival and will screen on Saturday, April 5th at the Chazen Museum of Art. Filmmaker NK joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, that you've done this portrait of your father, and you know, you tell his story, and you make a point of talking about how he really didn't talk about his early life much. How did you convince him to sit down for an interview and talk about this part of his life that he never talked about before?
Honestly, it wasn't that hard. he was very open to it, I think, because at the time when I reached out to him and I was like, Dad, I want to make a documentary about you, I think he was at a point in his life where he was like, you know what, I think I can tell my kids now, you know, and open up about my life. And I think when we were growing up, he really wanted to shield us from those traumatic experiences. And so now that we're adults, I feel like it just kind of all worked out in that way.
Now, there's a scene in the film where he's talking about using plastic bags under his armpits to swim across the Mekong River at the age of 13.
Yes.
As someone who was born in the United States, or how do you relate to something like that?
I don't know if I can. Honestly, like, I just can't imagine doing that myself. When my dad told me that story, it was just like, I was just like, how? Because he did it all by himself. And at nighttime too. So like, I'm just thinking about like how terrifying that must have been for someone his age, at the age of 13. But I honestly don't know how to like describe like how I felt and how he must have felt at that point.
And so one of the other things which I found really interesting about the film is that you use animation in it as part of the documentary. Tell us about that. Who did you do the animation yourself, or who did you work with to help do that?
I did do the animation. Yes, I was very inspired by another film called, I believe it's Freedom Swimmer. But I wanted, there were parts of my dad's story that I felt like couldn't be told through just B-roll or through appropriated footage. I wanted to give audiences a visual of what these moments felt like in his life. And so that's why I chose to do the animation.
Do you have a background in animation yourself?
I took a few animation classes. This was like my biggest animation piece that I've ever done. So it was a challenge. I only had like a month and a half to do it. And so...
You learned on the fly.
Yeah.
And you use a very simple style. How did you choose that style of drawing?
I just thought of like how I imagine my dad might draw, how this happened, you know, how his life happened, how he might have drawn as a kid. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I was like, oh, you know, maybe something more simple. But yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your dad's life. I mean, he escaped at 13. You know, how did he find his way to the United States? How did he end up in Wisconsin? And what did he do after he got here?
Yeah, so my dad, at the age of 13, decided to flee his country.
He was alone?
Yes.
He had
So he originally started out with a friend, but his brother, my dad's oldest brother, came to stop them from leaving. And my dad snuck away. Hmm. And so he made it to the river, and he described stepping on, like, feces. And, like, just, like, he was like, I just... ignored all that. I just wanted to get to Thailand. And he said he could see the lights across the ocean, or not the ocean, oh my gosh, the river.
Sure.
And he just decided with his heart that he was going to go across. And so he crossed the river, made it to Thailand, and there was someone there who was like, oh, throw your bags over here, your plastic bags. And these were the plastic bags that he had used and filled up with air to cross the river. And then that person, the Thai person, brought him to another person who I believe was an officer. And that officer took my dad to a jail where he was locked up for about a month before he was transferred over to the refugee camps. And with the refugee camps, my dad described it as you have to go through one refugee camp and then another one and then another one before you can come to the U.S. And the final refugee camp that he was in was Panatnakhum. And that's where they learned how to speak and read English, learned about owning a house and just like concepts in the U.S. that we would be like, oh, that's normal for us. Mm. But for many refugees was very new. And
was that camp operated by the U.S. government, or was it a charitable organization? Do you know?
I'm not entirely sure.
Your dad may not have known, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he was 13. Mm-hmm. It's probably, that might have been a subtlety that escaped him, especially under those circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then he flew with his brother. He actually met up with one of his brothers in the camps, and they flew together here to the U.S. And coming to Wisconsin, he started in California and then went to Georgia, and then his roommate actually was a relative of my mom's, and then his roommate came to visit my mom, who had just, her family had just arrived in the U.S. around like 1989, I believe. And he brought a photo of my mom back to my dad. And my dad was like head over heels for my mom. And that's essentially how my dad came to Wisconsin, because of my mom.
He came for love.
Yeah, exactly.
And so had they met before he came to Wisconsin?
No.
So this is a complete shot in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
They just eloped. My dad was just like, one day he was just like, hey, he called her and he was like, hey, I want to get married to you. Let's get married. And so he drove all the way up to Wisconsin and married my mom.
One of the other things I found interesting about the film is you interview your siblings, mm-hmm. And most of them you talk a little bit about how you got involved in. There was a family video camera that got mm-hmm. handed down and eventually landed in your hands, but you interview your siblings in their home or their community home, sitting on a sofa. But your dad, you interviewed in a garage. And tell us, why did you make that choice?
I made that choice because my dad's a mechanic. And it's interesting because I showed the film to my dad's brother, the one that he came with a few months ago. And he was like, your dad was born to fix cars. And I just felt like the shop is what we call it. The shop was where my dad probably feels most comfortable. Even though it's like very grimy and like there's roosters, I felt like this was a good place where my dad might feel like he could openly share his story.
Did it work?
Yeah.
did it require some any coaxing on your part to get him to open up about some of these events?
What was most challenging for me actually during the interview was that my Hmong isn't the best. Mm-hmm. I actually got a lot of help from my mom. We did a second interview with my dad after I had spoken to my mom. I felt like I told her after the first interview, I feel like I missed a lot of things or I didn't get a lot of the things that I wanted. And so she really helped me to translate my questions so that it would get to my dad.
And your dad doesn't speak English very, does he speak it at all or not, just not very well?
He doesn't speak very well, but when he tries, he's very good at it.
Everyone's more eloquent in their native language. And is that part of why you chose to ask your father questions and have him answer in Hmong,
mm-hmm,
with subtitles as opposed to trying to struggle through in English?
Yeah, that's exactly why, yeah.
So the film has won a Golden Badger Award. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Where have you screened it so far and what kind of reception have you got?
I've screened it at the Milwaukee Film Festival and the Fresh Coast Film Festival last year. It got a special mention by the jury at the Milwaukee Film Festival, and then it won Best Short Film at the Fresh Coast Film Festival. And my parents were very excited. My dad, when we went up to Marquette, Michigan for the Fresh Coast Film Festival, he just couldn't stop mentioning how much he misses Laos,
mm-hmm,
and how much this award means to him.
And you yourself are working in film production now. Tell us a little bit about your career and where you intend to take it.
Yeah, so I aspire to work in cinematography and lighting. And I really just want to continue sharing and telling more Hmong stories and Hmong experiences. I didn't see a lot of that growing up. I didn't learn about my own history in school. And so I really want to push for that and pursue that.
All right. We've been speaking with filmmaker Kung Swa Shung, or NK. Her film Why My Dad Loves screens on Saturday, April 5th at 4 o'clock p.m. at the Chazen Museum as part of the 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival. For tickets and more information, go to wifilmfest.org. NK, thank you so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock bus.
Thank you.
And that wraps up our program today. I'd like to thank our guests, Alexander Schur of VoteBeat Wisconsin, Wisconsin Secretary of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, Randy Romansky, and filmmaker NK. Thanks to our producer, Nicholas Wooten, who lined up the great guests you heard here on the program. Thanks also to our engineer, John Wilson, who piloted the mighty WORT soundboard and spun all the great tunes. Thanks to our receptionist, Lori Rainey. This is WORT 89.9 FM Madison. If you missed some of today's broadcast, or if you'd like to hear extended versions of many of our interviews, check out our archives and podcasts at WORTFM.org. My name is Brian Standing. Global Revolutions is coming your way right after the Insurgent Radio Kiosk.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, March 31st.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1969. That was the day Dr. Ralph Abernathy, president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, arrived in Charleston, South Carolina, to address striking hospital workers and their supporters. More than 400 black hospital workers at Medical College Hospital and Charleston County Hospital had walked off the job earlier in the month. They demanded an end to racial harassment and discrimination, wage increases, union recognition, and the reinstatement of fired co-workers. It was yet another instance where workers' struggles embodied the broader social debates of the day. Struggles for racial and gender equality, as well as the rights of public sector workers to organize, especially in the South, all converged in Charleston. Workers at both hospitals sought out Local 1199, which had already organized hospital workers in New York City. Local 1199B was soon chartered, and Mary Moultrie, a licensed nurse from Medical College Hospital, was elected president. 12 workers were fired when the new union demanded recognition. That's when they voted to go on strike. Picketers were met with injunctions and arrests. The president of MCH, William McCord, stated that he would not, quote, turn a $25 million complex over to a bunch of people who don't have a grammar school education. He and Governor Robert McNair cited the state's right-to-work law as justification for refusal.